Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men I admire most in America these days is a man with the long view of, well, this war for the free world, among other things, history more generally. He is really a polymath on all manner of subjects, including farming and the classics. He is Victor Davis Hanson, now the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is the author of some 17 books, including most recently The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost, from Ancient Greece to Iraq. He is the author as well of columns, including at National Review Online and Tribune Media Services, and published in all manner of other places. Heavens knows how he finds the time to do it, but we're grateful he's found the time to talk with us. Victor, welcome back. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I've been thinking of you a lot, Victor, as I've been watching what is happening in the United States Congress these days in terms of the serial accommodations, notably but not exclusively, by the United States Senate to the increasing lawlessness of this president. And I wonder whether a scholar like yourself of the classic period would say this looks eerily familiar from the perspective of what happened to Rome's Senate at the end of the Republic, when Caesar was clearly asserting himself more and more, and all of a sudden it was all gone. Are you seeing a parallel here?
Well, there was still a Senate under Augustus after the so-called settlement of 14 B.C., 21 B.C., etc. And then Augustus lived to be 77, and he basically ended Republican government. But the reason that, and this may sound similar, the reason that the Senate became a sideshow was that there was an enormous increase in personal wealth and affluence, and people were just sort of like the Kardashians, what Juvenal called bread and circuses. And that meant that people got enormous subsidies. Rome was above a million people, and people suggested half of them were on the dole. And then there were free entertainment, sort of like TV today, and people just lost an interest in the old give and take of local politics. And then the Senate themselves were, I guess the word would be, bought off individually by the emperor. It was such an imperial bureaucracy that they were promised all sorts of concessions, provincial governorships, proconsulships, tribuneships. So there was nearly no impetus to participate in politics. I feel sometimes that the Republican Senate or the opposition is so co-opted by the culture of Washington that they don't feel it's in their interest to be unpopular, to take on the president, to defend the Constitution, when the enticements are all in the other direction.
Another piece of the parallel, it seems to me, is that that extends to even the authorities and powers and responsibilities of the institution in which they serve. I think it's fair to say that the framers kind of thought that that would operate and ensure the continued viability of checks and balances, but it certainly seems to be over the side.
Yeah, I think the idea of the framers was that there would be all of these responsible people that would go to Washington, and then that would be considered a vocation, and then they would come back to their local communities and form them and then retire. They never envisioned that there'd be a permanent bureaucracy with big money and lifelong careers, and then going back in and out of government, or anything like the Clinton Foundation, anything like that. They didn't envision. I think that's the danger right now.
I want to come back to the Clinton Foundation in a moment, but just staying with this idea, an example of this is in play this week, as you know, Victor Davis Hanson, in the United States Senate, where a piece of legislation is being offered up by the chairman and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that would essentially turn on its head the constitutional process whereby treaties are considered. Is this of concern to you? I mean, in its own right, but specifically in the context of this Iran deal, which will be the subject of it.
All the way for the last 30 years, there's been presidential agreements that have superseded treaties for that very reason. They didn't want congressional sanction or approval. And this is only the most accelerated manifestation of that. So, yeah, I'm really worried because what's happening is the president is declaring something, a side agreement or a protocol, and therefore he seeks to avoid the Senate's input. And then the media, partisan media, jump in and says the Senate's disruptive or they're freelancing or they're unpatriotic. So very worried. In the case of Iran, you can see the problem with Iran, not from the Republican opposition or conservative worries or friends of Israel, but within the Democratic Party, the senior statesmen and independents are very worried about this agreement, and they're writing about it because everything he promised us, they would cease enrichment or they would send out enriched uranium to Russia or they would include Iran's terrorist activities as part of a general framework, or they would look at ballistic missiles. All of that has been tabled, and even the facilities they said that would be shut down are not going to be shut down. So every single item that he promised us that would be addressed is not being addressed, and the question is why. And he has a very meager record, and he feels that he wants to conclude an agreement before he goes out of office, and the bad side or the downside will be the problem of the next president.
Well, it is being aided and abetted, I guess, is the point here, by an institution that is supposed to serve, as you know so well, Victor Davis Hanson, as a quality control mechanism under our Constitution on precisely this kind of behavior, and they're capitulating. Let me turn to Hillary. Victor, again, you take the long view on these things, but there is something, it seems, quite historic at work here, as our friend and one of your colleagues out at the Hoover Institution, Peter Schweitzer, has established with his new book, Clinton Cash, that in manners that, again, were unimaginable to the founders through foundations and speakers' fees and other sweetheart deals, it seems Hillary Clinton has enabled, if not actually participated in, a kind of access and influence and pay-to-play kind of operation that has enriched her family unbelievably and at the detriment of the American people.
The left doesn't have a defense of it because how can you? Because it's pretty clear that they had this annual budget of, I don't know what it was, $500 million they were spending, and only a sixth of it was going to actual grants. The vast five-sixths of it was going to travel and salaries for the cronies, $70 million on jet travel for the Clintons over the last few years. And when you start seeing things like allowing Putin to gain access to uranium supplies in the United States, or the human tragedy in Haiti and seeing a brother-in-law Bill Clinton, brother of Hillary Clinton, getting involved in a gold mining concession, it's so sordid. And then why would anybody want to pay Bill Clinton $500,000 at opportune
time? Or $750,000.
Like $750,000 in one case, exactly. And then you see that any communication about this would be wiped off a server, and that you understand now the purpose of the private communications of Hillary Clinton. And I could go on, but the only defense of it on the left is sort of that CIA cliche in the 60s. He may be an SOB, but he's ours. And their idea is she may be an SOB, but she's ours and she's all we got. So they're going to stick with her. And I have a feeling that when they unleash the Clinton attack machine and they go on, it's a long campaign, that she will probably still be the nominee. The degree to which the Republicans are able to make this an issue, and it should be an issue, we'll have to wait and see. But I've watched my whole life the Clintons, and I've seen the cattle trade, I've seen Travelgate, I've seen Monica, I've seen Whitewater, I've seen missing files, I've seen it all. I thought when Hillary Clinton said just last week that she deplored the activity of hedge funds and CEOs, that the fact that her son-in-law is a hedge fund operator, her daughter is worth $15 million after working for a hedge fund. She has an office in a hedge fund, and she charges $300,000 to a public university for speaking, and then deplores CEO inequality. I thought, that's so shameless that people won't let her get away, but nobody said a word. So the left's attitude is, she's all we got, we're going to go down with her. And Wall Street sort of likes her because she's sort of an insurance. She has that populist veneer, and she winks and nods to them and says, I'm going to trash you guys in public, but privately it's business as usual.
I frankly think, Victor, for what it's worth, that this is a bridge too far. I think there may be criminal wrongdoing.
There is criminal wrongdoing. I'm convinced of it. But if you look at what Governor McDonald in your state, or you look at what Conrad Black was brought up on, or Dinesh D'Souza or Senator Menendez, by any standard, she should have been indicted a long time ago. But the fact that she hasn't tells me that she won't be indicted. and not when Obama's president.
Well, we will be tracking this closely and agree that it will be an interesting run for sure. Victor Davis Hanson, you are one of the most interesting men in America. It's always a pleasure and privilege to talk with you. I look forward to doing so again soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work at Hoover and in your various other outlets, and we'll talk with you soon. Rosemary Jenks joins us. We'll talk with her about this immigration free fall in terms of the rule of law. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Over the last week, it has become clear that the so-called framework agreement announced by the Obama administration to bring about a comprehensive nuclear deal with Iran is in deep trouble. Iranian officials have disagreed with the Obama administration's account of the framework, especially over verification and sanctions relief. Contrary to U.S. claims that there will be strict verification and phased sanctions relief, Iranian leaders have said verification efforts will be limited, with military facilities off limits. They also insist that sanctions must be completely terminated, not suspended, once a final agreement is signed. So if there was not agreement on the framework, what's going on here? The likely explanation is that the framework is a fraud to stop Congress from passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran or requiring a congressional vote on a final nuclear agreement. It is my hope Congress will not be fooled by this obvious fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by one of my favorite friends and colleagues, particularly in the fight of this war for the free world that is very much the home front fight, the battle space of the immigration issue and what is being done by President Obama in really a comprehensive way, not only to mutate our rule of law and specifically our immigration statutes, but more generally to assault the Constitution. She is Rosemary Jenks, an attorney by training. She is currently the Director of Government Relations at Numbers USA, one of the most effective people I know in Washington, D.C., as is her organization tremendously important in terms of helping the rest of us understand what is going on and coming up with strategies to try to make sure that the Constitution, our security interests, and our borders are all secure. Rosemary Jenks, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
It's always great to be with you, Frank.
I wanted to take stock with you on sort of the assessment of the damage being done to the rule of law with the confirmation last week of Loretta Lynch as the top law enforcement officer in light of some of the things that she apparently is determined not to enforce in terms of our laws. Where do you find us at this point in the aftermath of the Senate's confirmation of Loretta Lynch?
Well, you know, Frank, it would be difficult to imagine any Obama nominee for attorney general not saying that he or she supports President Obama's goals and agenda. However, the fact that Loretta Lynch specifically said that she believes in the constitutionality, the legality of President Obama's immigration actions, the amnesty for 5 million people, is really astonishing. And the fact that Republicans would go ahead and confirm her despite that is just astonishing. And it's a hugely significant thing for the United States of America and for the concept of the rule of law when the top law enforcement officer of the nation does not believe in the Constitution or the laws. And she's going to take an oath to support them, and yet she has already stated unequivocally that she doesn't believe in them.
Rosemary Jenks is our guest. She is the Director of Government Relations at the incalculably important Numbers USA, a tremendous resource for what is happening with respect to immigration policy in the United States, the insecurity of our border, and what average Americans can do to try to make sure that we do not continue down the road of, well, inviting in illegal aliens en masse and creating conditions under which our polity and perhaps our country itself will be transformed fundamentally, as they say. Rosemary, you were talking about the Republican role in confirming, sort of looking the other way. There was a bit of a two-step, as they do often in the Senate. People voted to allow her to proceed to confirmation and then turned around and voted against her nomination. What's up with that?
Well, first of all, Frank, you need to take one more step back. The fact is that Mitch McConnell was under absolutely no obligation to bring her up for a vote at all. So he could have avoided the whole thing. He didn't want to do that. So it's Mitch McConnell who decided that Loretta Lynch was going to get a vote. And then in order to avoid having a Republican senator challenge the nuclear option that Harry Reid put in place last year, they had a cloture vote, which requires a 60-vote majority, to move to the vote on Loretta Lynch. It was all a farce. It was essentially just Mitch McConnell was absolutely determined that he was going to have a vote on Loretta Lynch. Everyone knew because five Republicans had already declared they were going to support her that she was going to pass. So it was just a charade.
Once the vote was in order. And as you say, he clearly wanted her confirmed. I mean, he did take this step, and then he actually voted for her, as I recall. So the implication being very clear that the Obama administration is not the only perpetrator of this wrecking operation on our immigration policies. It is being enabled by the Republican leadership, at least for the moment in the Senate. Rosemary, one other place where this is in evidence, and you have been tracking it closely, I know, at Numbers USA, is the refugee resettlement program and something called parole. Talk a little bit about how that is being used also to undermine caps on the numbers of refugees and legal aliens that can come to this country.
Well, Frank, some very damaging things have come out of this administration in just the last few months. So first, we all remember the huge border surge of supposedly unaccompanied minors and family units from Central America last summer. Well, that border surge has continued. And so we're still seeing very, very large numbers of these supposedly unaccompanied minor children who are actually accompanied by cartel smugglers and the family units.
And not always children either.
Right, exactly. And the family units, which is usually a mother and her children. So instead of dealing with that situation by deterring it, by telling these Central Americans, you're not going to be able to stay if you come to America, so there's no point in coming, the president decided that he is going to send the United States, the State Department, and the Immigration Service to Central America, to these three countries, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and actually process folks there and fly them to the United States on taxpayer dollars and then enroll them in all the welfare programs that we offer here. And the way he's doing that is to
everything. They get every taxpayer subsidized benefit. Yeah.
Everything that U.S. citizens are entitled to, these folks will be entitled to as well. So he's doing that by pretending that these are refugees. Now, there's a very specific legal international definition of a refugee, which means that you have to have a well-founded fear of persecution, state persecution, on grounds of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Obviously, Central Americans who are fleeing economic poverty, gang violence, cartel violence, don't qualify under any of those definitions. So what the president has done is order the Immigration Service to actually change the definition of a particular social group so that now it includes people who have reported gang violence to law enforcement and single female heads of households. So all of the family units, the mothers with their children, instead of having to come up through Mexico by themselves with the smugglers, we're going to process them in Central America, call them refugees, and then fly them here to live in America permanently on our dollars.
They don't even have to make the dangerous migration. They are able to get a taxpayer-subsidized airfare and flight here. One of the other pieces of this that is simply mind-boggling is that we've got now an initiative called Communities Welcoming New Americans as a vehicle for trying, apparently, to facilitate all of this repopulation of America. Very quickly, tell us about that initiative, who's behind it, and what its implications are.
Well, this is actually one of two executive orders that the president announced in November when he announced his amnesty, his latest amnesty. And what he is doing is essentially using taxpayer dollars, again, because, you know, money grows on trees in this administration, and he is bringing in all of the federal executive agencies, Department of Housing, Transportation, Health and Human Services, all of them.
Now 16
and
of
using
them,
taxpayer, yes, and using taxpayer dollars so that those departments and agency heads will go into communities and ensure that there are essentially non-assimilated immigrant communities within those American communities that are being provided with taxpayer-funded services that are being naturalized.
This is appalling and the subject of a much longer conversation we will hopefully have with you in the very near future. Rosemary Jenks, thank you again for what you do at Numbers USA and for giving us this update on so many different pieces of the challenge that we're facing. Keep up your great work, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Shoshana Bryan about what the administration is doing in the way of a wrecking operation on our relationship with Israel. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your every day.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Hillary Clinton was not much of a New Yorker, even though she got to play one in the Senate for a time. Even she must be familiar, however, with a classic New York phrase, "Forget about it." That's what Mrs. Clinton should do about her underwhelming campaign for the presidency. If she doesn't do it voluntarily, however, it seems likely that she will soon be forced out, especially in light of the serial scandals exposed in best-selling author Peter Schweitzer's new book, Clinton Cash. In a Sunday morning TV discussion of the implications of Schweitzer's revelations, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich declared, quote, "If this was any person but Hillary Clinton, they'd be under indictment right now," unquote. Under the Obama administration, Hillary may never actually be indicted, but if she thinks she can win, forget about it. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, and I couldn't be more pleased to be joined by another old friend, a friend of many years, I guess is what one's supposed to say at this point in one's life. She is Shoshana Bryan. She is the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of the Jewish Policy Center's superb magazine, In Focus. She's really one of those people with extraordinary corporate memory about the Mideast, a go-to resource for, I think, people both in government and the rest of us in the Washington community, and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much, Shoshana, for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Frank.
You have recently written about your concerns that the president and his minions, notably Samantha Power, our UN ambassador, have really signaled that they plan to kind of upend, not just realign, but I think fundamentally transform, to coin a phrase, America's relationship with its most important ally, certainly in the region, namely Israel. What do you make of what's going on, and what are the implications specifically if the threats that we won't support Israel at the UN are allowed to materialize?
Well, Samantha Power's comment, which was, you can't guarantee a U.S. veto in Israel's favor at the UN. We'll be with Israel, and she said, in quotes, when it matters, leaving the definition of when it matters to the U.S. administration. But this is only the end of a series of comments the President and Secretary of State Kerry, both of whom are Samantha Power's bosses, have made, and it is their determination that Israel will be held differently. Both of them, the President and the Secretary of State, have made comments in the past that Israel is strong, Israel is wealthy, Israel is not very interested in peace because it is strong and wealthy. That was Secretary Kerry in Israel before a meeting with Israel's president. And because of that, Israel has some responsibility to fix the problem in the Middle East. Israel is not threatened by the Arab states. Israel is the powerful, wealthy, confident power, and it is that power that needs to make concessions.
The president, as I recall, actually said something to the effect that I don't worry about Israel's survival. And yet he's also saying, Shoshana, that, will determine what will advance Israel's security. I must say, this is the height of arrogance and indifference to the actual interests, let alone sovereignty, of a key ally, isn't it?
Well, now you understand, or you've put your finger on, the origin of the poor relationship between the United States and Israel. The United States, in the form of President Obama, did exactly say, I don't worry about Israel's survival, I worry about what kind of Israel survives. Israel, as a sovereign country, wishes to determine for itself, first of all, how it survives, which means its defense policy should be created in Jerusalem by Israelis for Israelis. And so they resent very much the president talking about how they survive and under what circumstance. And secondly, the president's determination that it is no longer a threatened country. So that is what aggravates the Israelis, and that is what is poisoning the relationship. It's the president's arrogance. It's the president's determination that he can decide for Israel how Israel should live and how Israel should defend itself.
It's almost inconceivable that we would tolerate anyone else saying such things about or to us. But especially at a moment, Shoshana Bryan, as you understand better than just about anybody, when there is real reason to be concerned about Israel's survival, not just what kind of Israel survives, but the Jewish state itself surviving. Talk a little bit about the threats that now are emerging, running the gamut from nuclear weapons the administration seems to be greenlighting for Iran, all the way to the literal states around Israel, every single one of which now seems to be either up for grabs or already in enemy hands.
Well, I would say from the Israeli literal perspective, the relationship with Egypt has improved enormously, as the Egyptians and Israelis share the view of the Sinai that it is overrun with jihadis and it needs to be fixed. Also, Egypt and Israel share a view of Hamas. And the Egyptians under al-Sisi are doing their best to fix the problem. I'm not sure that they can fix it, by the way. I am not sure that the Egyptians have the ability to control the Sinai from the jihadists, but at least they're on the same page. Jordan is enormously threatened by the war in Syria. Huge numbers of refugees in Jordan. And although Jordan and Israel have a peace treaty, the more threatened Jordan feels, the more difficult it is for Israel. And then you go to the places where Israel has real physical threats, and that is from the Syrian border and from the Lebanese border. And there, everything is up for grabs. There are no good parties in the war in Syria. The Assad government is not a good party. The Islamic State is clearly not a good party. The so-called moderate rebels have been co-opted by Islamists of various stripes. Hezbollah is there, armed by Iran, protected by the Russians. The Israelis have a tremendous problem on their northern border.
There appears to be evidence that the Iranians themselves, in the form of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, are now operating in proximity to the Golan, and we've seen some exchanges of fire, some of which have actually killed those personnel. So in addition, there is this natty problem of Hamas in Gazastan. And as you say, the Israelis now have kind of a partner with whom to work again in Egypt, thank God. But that's a rather touchy situation, I think, in that the Muslim Brotherhood and its allies are very much seeking to overthrow the government of President al-Sisi. So all of these really point to the larger import of what we've been discussing, Shoshana, and that is this is no time to be weakening our ally, let alone encouraging enemies of Israel to think that they can have a free shot because America will not, in fact, stand with Israel, is it?
That is totally correct. What you have around Israel is a variety of nasty players. And the one thing that helps a country like Israel or Jordan or Egypt, all three of which should be considered American allies, none of which are treated particularly well by the Obama administration, what helps them to stiffen their resolve in the face of those enemies is the understanding that the United States is behind them. Well, the United States, in the form of President Obama and Secretary Kerry and Ambassador Power, are not behind them. They've made it clear that they're not behind them. And then you go one step higher and you say, what about Iran? And you've pointed out correctly that the Iranians are actually in Syria. And that's one level of Iranian trouble. The other level of Iranian trouble, as you've mentioned, is nuclear weapons and the potential for nuclear weapons and the potential for long-range missiles.
I just wanted to get at this point that you sort of touched on earlier, that if in the United Nations context we're signaling that the Palestinians can now have their way, that they can bring suits against Israel in the International Criminal Court, charging its people or officials or government with war crimes. They can press forward on demands for recognition of the Palestinian state. Or they can seek other boycott, divestment, sanctions kinds of impacts on Israel. We will, in fact, intensify this sense, I'm imagining, on the part of a lot of very bad actors, not just Palestinians, but that it's game on for Israel, driving it into the sea as they've long sought to do. And Shoshana, I guess if you were advising the president or simply as you are, I know, advising members of Congress at such a time, what would you counsel?
As you might imagine, the president has not asked me lately for my opinion.
Or mine. The beauty of this is we get to give it to him anyway. Hopefully he's listening.
Well, I hope so. It would do him some good. I think what he needs to understand, what the administration needs to understand, and some of its allies in Congress, is it's worse than encouraging the Palestinians. U.S. policy is still that the Palestinians ought not to do these things. It ought not to go to the International Criminal Court. It ought not to go to the Security Council. And by the way, Secretary Kerry has been public about that. In the face of that, the Palestinians have said essentially, we don't care what you want. We're doing it anyway. And that's worse.
And then Samantha Power is sort of signaling, well, we won't necessarily object if they do this.
But we might. And so they are saying to her, we don't care what you want. And that makes us look terrible.
Shoshana, just in 30 seconds, if you can. Is part of the problem here that we not only have a misbegotten policy set by the president, but that he thinks American Jews are okay with what he's doing to Israel?
There is a small fraction of American Jews known as J Street, which is in fact okay with it. And that's what the president calls into the White House when he wants a comfortable meeting. He calls the J Street Jews. They do not represent the American Jewish community. They are very small. They are supported by a couple of very large donors, and that's it. But he thinks they represent a significant slice of American Jewry. He's wrong.
I hope he is indeed not only wrong, but that he will be corrected about it. Shoshana Bryan, you do marvelous work at the Jewish Policy Center, which you are the senior director for, as well as at In Focus magazine. Keep it up. Come back for a longer conversation soon, if you would.
Thank you, Frank.
Next up, we'll be talking with Gordon Chang, among other things, about what's happened to the people of Nepal, what it means for Asia, and also what the Trans-Pacific Partnership means for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang, a man we consult with each week, it's really one of the high points of our program, is our duty expert on Asia. He is also that of Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com and, well, I think Fox News, among many, many others. He is deeply knowledgeable about developments in Asia, particularly with respect to China, the subject of one of his books, The Coming Collapse of China. And we look forward to our opportunities to take stock with him as to what's going on there at the moment. And, of course, Gordon, in addition to welcoming you, which I'm always happy to do, let me just say my heart goes out to the folks in Nepal who are clearly struggling terribly in the face of not only the initial terrible quake there, but also the after effects of it. What can you tell us about what's happening on the ground there?
Nepalis have been talking about this earthquake coming for quite some time. And fortunately, it wasn't at a point when kids were in school, and this could have been so much worse. But of course, the death toll is horrific. The real issue here is that the Nepali government has turned down assistance from Taiwan, and undoubtedly they did this at Beijing's behest. Now, Taiwan has some of the best search and rescue capabilities in the region, and so this is politics getting in the way of saving lives. This is, of course, something that is going to be discussed going forward, because we can't allow this to occur as Beijing essentially adopts the anti-Taiwan policy that is essentially killing people.
Yeah, quite literally. Talk, if you would, just very quickly about the nature of the political situation in Nepal at the moment. I know communists, Maoists, have been very much active there for some time and have destabilized the country in the past. Is this a vehicle for Chinese leverage, Gordon, or is that a thing of the past?
Well, the Chinese are their influence is receding in Nepal, but nonetheless, they still are the most influential outside force. And because of that, essentially, the kingdom has been thrown into turmoil. So China's influence has been particularly bad in Nepal. This is going to be important because going forward, India is going to try to regain some of the clout that it's lost. And we're going to see Nepal essentially as, I wouldn't say a playground, but certainly as an arena where New Delhi and Beijing are going to be struggling against each other for a friend.
Well, it will be probably the great game, maybe on a smaller scale than with the Western powers in the past elsewhere in Central and South Asia. What is the role more generally of China, I guess, is one of the concerns that we touch on each week, Gordon. And you've written recently about some of the steps that the Chinese are taking to stimulate their economy. You've pointed to indicators that are suggesting it is, in fact, contracting, if not collapsing, certainly contracting. And that's a problem for the Chinese, as you so well know. What is the nature of the intervention that the Chinese government is making at the moment, and do you think it's likely to make things better for them economically?
The most recent intervention has been Beijing reducing the reserve requirement ratio. This is the requirement that banks keep funds at the central bank, and because they keep the funds there, it means that the banks cannot lend them out. The reduction was 1 percentage point. Which released somewhere between $200 to $400 billion in liquidity into the Chinese economy. But as has been recently reported, the banks don't know what to do with the extra money because there are no productive lending uses. And so this money is got to find a home somewhere. A lot of it will go into the stock market to fuel this boom that we've been seeing over the last 18 months. And this is going to be really important going forward because this boom has got to collapse.
Yeah, there's a bubble there somewhere for sure. Gordon, one of the other interventions, as I understand it, is something called the Internet Plus strategy. What's that about, and how is that likely to play into the future prospects for the Chinese economy?
Internet Plus is Premier Li Keqiang's attempt to sort of change the structure of the Chinese economy away from heavy industrialization towards Internet industries and using the Internet to make most businesses in China more efficient. The problem here is that, in general, this is a good idea, of course, because China does need to move away from the coal mines and the steel mills. But what he's going to probably do is try to pick the winners and losers in the Internet industry, and that's not a good thing. This is a segment of the Chinese economy that can do well if it's left alone.
Mm, but that's not the economic model of the communists, needless to say. It'll be interesting to see whether they wind up mutating it beyond recognition, as they have other parts of the economy with their state-owned enterprises, as you say, particularly the heavy industries. Gordon, let me turn to another issue that is now moving to the forefront of Washington's political activity, and that is something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a massive trade deal. It is being negotiated, as best I can tell, almost entirely in secret. The administration is seeking congressional approval for something called Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, that would essentially fast-track congressional consideration of whatever deal comes out of all of this so-called TPP process. This is something that I must say I'm concerned about, this fast-track authority, which is more or less a rubber stamp. It's a kind of up or down vote under circumstances that don't lend itself to saying no. But what are your thoughts on this arrangement, its necessity, whether China will in fact be kept out of it, and whether Congress should in fact give this kind of, fast-track promotion authority?
Yeah. TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, is something that has existed in the past, and it was allowed to expire. It's extremely controversial because essentially it gives the administration the ability to say to Congress, take or leave a trade deal. What Congress has done in extending TPA, and that has gone through committee, is essentially to allow a cooling off period in which Congress can actually look at the next trade deal coming up, and that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, like other major trade deals, is going to raise numerous issues. The big issue here, I think, though, is China. And the important point is the United States wants a trade structure for Asia that is written by countries in the region, including the United States, and not including China, because the Chinese, as we know, are predatory and even more mercantilist than they've been in the past, and their influence in trade arrangements has been baneful.
It is the position of the government, as I understand it, the U.S. government, that there is some kind of special docking provision, Gordon, that would allow China to come into this arrangement sometime down the road. If the principal merit of this is that it excludes China, does that affect your consideration of whether this is desirable? And how would you respond to the concerns that I certainly have that this kind of secret deal negotiated out of the public eye, mostly by special interests, and then presumably blown through Congress if the administration has its way, may well wind up being something that's really not free trade in the end after all?
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a high-standard deal, and China will not be able to meet the standards that are incorporated into its provisions. So even though there may be a docking provision, the Chinese are not going to be able to dock. They're going to have to make concessions that they've never been willing to make and can't make in their present system. You know, with regard to Trade Promotion Authority, this has been something which has been discussed for decades. I think the administration should have been much more open with various industry segments about what is they're negotiating in the TPP, because that would eventually help passage of the deal. With regard to the general nature of up or down votes, those are essentially requirements for a major trade deal, because you couldn't get any major trade deal through Congress if you didn't have some sort of promotion authority. But nonetheless, the administration has been much too secret in the way that they have gone about the TPP negotiations, and I think unnecessarily so.
I think that's all true, and I can't think of a single agreement or deal that this administration has struck on anything, Gordon, that I think stands up to scrutiny. So it makes me a little suspicious about this one, let alone giving them a trade promotion authority to blow it through Congress, as I say. More on this later. We will look forward to talking with you about it. Gordon, I know you're covering it closely, and we appreciate, as always, your insights. Gordon Chang, the author of The Coming Collapse of China and superb columns at the Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com websites. Gordon, thanks so much for your time and your extraordinary contributions. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.